You're listening to the Information Advantage, WILL Urbana. This is a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. My name's Todd Gleason. I'm the host of the Closing Market Report in studio, along today with Dave Dickey, the Director of Agricultural Programming. Good afternoon to you, Dave. Glad to have you alongside us for this, extra special beginning of a six-series discussion of ag policy issues.
It's not too early to begin these discussions. Already farm bureaus around the country are talking about farm policy issues, and by the end of this year, we'll have their position papers ready to go to present to congressmen and other shakers and movers regarding farm bill policy implementation.
And we would like to thank the Champaign County Farm Bureau folks for giving this idea to us and helping us set some of this up, putting things on the plate that we can talk to the analyst and you as well. We'll open up the phone lines here in just a bit and let you ask some questions. So if you happen to be in the tractor or out in the shop, have your cell phone ready. We'll open the phone lines up momentarily for you to give us a call. The idea, of course, is to get farmers and others prepared for the farm bill debate that will be coming up in the next year or so. And certainly by the time the July and August rolls around here in the state of Illinois and in the state of Indiana, the farm policy discussions that will be taking place as they head into the end of the year and their annual conventions, which take place in the last couple of months of this year. Online with us today, a couple of experts in this area. Bob Spitzi is with us. Bob is a retired professor emeritus from the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics here at the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences from the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And Mike Bolgi is with us. Mike conducts research and teaches in the area of farm and agribusiness management finance at Purdue University. He's in the Ag Econ there, a department there in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
It is good to have both of you on. Dave and I had a discussion about this, and we decided that it was really important that we find out where we've been before we decided we should discuss where we might go with farm policy. And Bob, I'd like you, Spitzi, to take up for us just a bit of how ag policy developed in the United States over the last couple of hundred years.
Yes, it's an extremely interesting review of history. So much of the focus these days is upon the current issue of aid to farmers and other sectors of the economy and trade, but actually this sometimes overshadows the long history of agriculture and food policy that's been extremely important in this country. For over 200 years, the federal government, along with farmers, have been partners to work out a variety of problems having to do with such things as land settling, land distribution, with education, public schools out in the communities, the land grant system, education extended out into the countryside with the extension service, our research facilities, and also the massive, important credit agencies that have been fostered by the federal government and sometimes continue to be supported. Those focused was the focus of attention for many, many years. And it's only the last three-quarters of a century that the focus has somewhat shifted toward what we often call price and income policy, having to do with more direct intervention of the federal government into the pricing or the marketing of farm products. And certainly that is important in many of the issues that were treated in early years resurface again, such as environmental issues, soil conservation, and trade.
And, of course, we'll take those issues up as they concern commodity prices. I think those began in the 30s with the 1933 Act and a 1938 Act. But I would like to stay with some of the beginning issues of commerce and trade and education that developed the USDA and the land grant system. How did all that take place?
The land distribution is perhaps one of the most interesting. To think that this vast countryside was under the control of this nation, of the federal government. And the question was, how do we distribute that? Do we want to distribute it in large holdings, have feudal estates, haciendas, or do we want to put it in the hands of working farmers? And those decisions shaped the Homestead Act way back in the mid-1800s. In addition, the question of, can we do anything to educate the public out across the rural communities in order to be able to get themselves educated and informed. And the one-room school that some of us still remember was actually established by land grants to rural communities, townships, to establish a school. And later on in the mid-1800s, then the question of a more comprehensive research and education program at the higher education level, and that's when the land grant system came into being in 1862, starting focus on providing education for agriculture, domestic science, and industrial arts in every state of the United States. This was augmented later on with facilities and funds for research and the extension service. In each of these cases, it was a partnership where the federal government offered certain inducements or assistance and expected in return certain kind of performances and certain kinds of services being offered.
Mike, what do you say that the headwaters were for the current farm policy, and where does that really take up in the history of agricultural policy in the United States?
Well, I think if you go back to what Bob was talking about, there was really a focus prior to the Depression period on assisting agriculture in a kind of a more indirect fashion by facilitating the educational process, by facilitating the information process, by helping them get access to some of the resources like land to help them be their R&D, their research and development activity, et cetera. So it was kind of a more indirect a support of the industry. But then starting basically during the 30s, late 20s and the 30s, when we had the significant, and even somewhat before that in the teens, but it was really enforced during that period of time when we had the significant financial crisis of the Depression that influenced not only the whole country but agriculture, then we moved to a much more direct kind of assistance to the industry, and that has since early last century has taken various and sundry forms in terms of price and income supports implemented in various ways. Almost all of those, though, have some link to the production capacity of the farming operation, linked to the land, linked to the productivity of that land. In more recent years now, we've added some additional programming focused, for example, on risk management with crop insurance programs. We also started during that same period of time, that is back again early last century, the programs to assist farmers in terms of accessing the capital markets through assistance to farm cooperatives. The farm credit system origins are back in that period of time, which now has been moved back to a privatized farmer cooperative type of structure. So kind of the origins of where we are today did start, certainly 75, 80 years ago, and we are focused now on kind of two types of programs for agriculture in a broad context. One is the direct assistance programs of farm payments, and then we still have a very strong indirect assistance in the form of again, R&D through the land grant system, educational systems as well. There's increasing focus on rural community assistance today compared to what there used to be. And then part of the current U.S. Department of Agriculture, at least, is also focused very explicitly on food assistance for low-income people through the food stamps program.
If you would like to be part of the discussion as well, you can do so by getting on your phone and calling us up at 217-333-9455. That's our local number. Our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Good for anywhere you can hear us. Mike, it's my understanding that as you look through the farm program history that essentially you have kind of three major eras. You have a price support era in the 30s where the government was sort of overly supporting farm programs. You had an income support era that came into effect in the 70s to about 95 where U.S. farmers It was realized they were missing an opportunity to sell U.S. farm products for dollars in international markets, and so we have mechanisms in place to deal with that. To now, what we have is a market-oriented era, essentially 96 to now, where farmers finally free to make some decisions for themselves based on market prices as opposed to government-determined payments. Is that essentially how you view it, too?
Well, I think you, if you look at the history that you described, it is the case that there have been, modest shifts in at least the rhetoric and the focal point of the programs early on, as you indicate, price support programs. But even today, much of the assistance for agriculture has a price impact, so it's not quite the same mechanism for impacting incomes. But the reason we had price support programs back in the 30s and later was to enhance the incomes. We had programs in the 70s that were trying to basically enhance farmers' incomes through supply control types of programs, where we were trying to reduce the amount of production that was on the market, which the argument was depressing prices, and so one way to do that is to have set asides and other types of programs to pull back production. So as a quid pro quo for getting government payments during that period of time, you had to set aside some acreage or pull acreage down. And then, as you indicate, we did change direction and say, well, those kinds of programs are not allowing us to take advantage of global opportunities to expand the market. So what we did instead was say we will work on market expansion, and hopefully market expansion will result in enough increased demand that we don't have to provide quite as much buffering of farmers from the lower prices that might recall from oversupplying that market. What we did find that demand didn't grow fast enough to accomplish that, and or supplies in other parts of the world grew fast enough, and or the weather didn't cooperate, and so we then had to kind of revert to income assistance programs, in these cases not tied explicitly to prices, but to income supports that are triggered when prices go below certain levels. But all of these programs still have kind of a fundamental focus on trying to buffer farmers from the circumstances that would exist from low prices. They're in many cases just different emphases on and different mechanisms for how we try to accomplish that goal.
We have a caller on our toll-free line. Caller, where are you calling from?
Well, I didn't get your local number, so I'm calling you on your 800 number. I'm in Urbana, unfortunately.
Very good. Do you have a question or comment for our guests?
Yes, I was somewhat interested in your guests' opinions on the way the farm programs are structured now. Several years ago, there were some websites that showed what the large farmers were receiving in the way of government payments. And it appeared to me, and I'm sure quite a few other people, that the way the farm programs are structured, the large farmers are getting hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in government assistance. And a lot of these fellas are already multi-millionaires. And the smaller farmers are getting just enough to hang on by the skin of their teeth. And I've seen numbers since then that show that I think 15% of the farmers get 80% of the program revenues. Those figures might not be exact, but I think they're close. And I'd like to know what your guest's opinion is on this.
Bob, do you want to go ahead and take that one? First off, verify that the caller indeed is right with those numbers, and perhaps a little bit of how we got to there.
Yes, certainly. I think the caller's perception is in the ballpark, and it focuses on the origin of these policies and what we still think we're trying to do. The programs have been, as Mike indicated, primarily focused on bolstering, on trying to augment what the market does for farmers, not to substantially change the distribution of production nor of income. And as is well known, I'm sure, by the caller and others, the distribution of production income is highly skewed in this country, increasingly so, toward the larger units, largely due to efficiencies of production and the way the whole industry is organized and how the market system works. And so the public figures, our elected officials, as they have wrestled with this, have continued to confront the problem. Do we use these kinds of programs to substantially alter the distribution of income, or do we essentially leave that open to the market forces and then augment what the market provides with additional help? And I would say that in earlier years, there was somewhat more tilting toward what the caller would say would be the smaller farmers, in the sense that there were limits on payments, or limits on the volume that could receive price support. And those perhaps had some minor effect upon distribution, but certainly in recent years, the focus has been, I think, much more toward letting the market determine this. Perhaps this prevails throughout our whole culture and our whole society, not just in agriculture. And so there's been somewhat less inclination, as I see it, on our democratic system to say we're going to use this kind of assistance to change that. And this is certainly open to controversy. There are valid reasons for people to feel differently about it. But that's the nature of it. If we're going to use these programs to substantially alter the structure of agriculture or the income distribution, then certainly there would have to be major changes in them.
Let me just piggyback on that just a second, because I think it is important to understand that there has historically not been a, quote, needs test that has been part of the criteria upon which we make these program payments. And so it hasn't been any type of attempt to assess, well, are certain size farmers more worthy and or financially needy of these kinds of payments than other size farmers? And so there hasn't been this attempt historically to try to, as Bob's indicating, to try to kind of alter the distribution of income, large versus small, and or the distribution of wealth, large versus small. And the program payments have consequently, mechanically have been tied to, again, production land. The more you produce, the more land you have, the more you get paid. Now, having said that, there have been in recent times more explicit debates about this very issue of should these target programs be targeted as a function of farm size or other characteristics. There was a commission that was initiated after the last farm bill to look at this issue. Senator Grassley from Iowa in the previous 2002 legislation did introduce some amendments to the bill to target payments, to put payment limitations on. There are actually payment limitations in place now, but they are relatively easy to manage around on the part of larger scale farmers. But one of the very interesting most recent events in this context is in the president's proposal as part of the president's budget. He has proposed two things. One is a reduction of farm program payments, but quite significantly, and maybe the most significant, is a payment limitation. My recollection is it's a $250,000 per farm limitation on government farm program payments. And so what he is attempting to do is to try to at least or some people would suggest this will at least result in that issue being more explicitly debated than it might have been in the past, of whether these program payments should be targeted to a particular size of farming operation compared to the way they've been paid in past years.
You're listening to WILL Urbana. My name's Todd Gleason. On line with us this afternoon, Mike Bolgi, who is an ag economist at Purdue University in Lafayette, Indiana. I think you just heard him speaking. And Bob Spitzy, who is a retired professor emeritus from the Ag Econ Department here at the University of Illinois and the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. Our thanks to the caller who just called in. We do have another caller online. By the way, if you'd like to join our discussion, you can. The numbers are 333-9455 locally or 800-222-9455, and the phone lines are starting to fill up. We'll go to line one. Good afternoon to you. How are you today?
Hello.
And your question is?
I wonder if either or both of the speakers could say a bit more about the R&D subsidy. In particular, I'm aware that the Department of Agriculture was the largest R&D performer up until sometime maybe in the 1930s or so. And I'm interested in the intellectual property policies and results from the R&D. So I don't know if this is an area that you would know much about, but apparently there was a policy before World War One and after World War One of dedicating the results of publicly funded R&D in the Department of Agriculture to the public. And I'm wondering if there's much in the way of intellectual property generation now, and how would you characterize the R&D subsidy? Who receives it, and kind of what are the major lines of research? Thank you very much. I'll hang up.
Mike, why don't you take that topic up if you can?
Yeah, well, let me just make a few comments on this. I don't want to express I'm not an expert in R&D policy in both the public and the private sector, but a couple, three, I think, relevant observations here. The perspective, I think, that Bob indicated in the earlier comments was that many of the smaller-scale operations in agriculture just didn't have the capacity to do their own R&D, and so that was one of the original activities that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was very involved in and continues to be heavily involved in, and that was basically publicly accessible R&D and made available through our outreach and extension services, as well as through the land grant system classroom to any and all. I mean, our extension programs have been pretty much freely available to anybody. There's not the fee schedules that you might have in a private sector educational experience, whether it be out in the countryside. More recently, there has been considerable debate about this issue. There's two things going on in terms of R&D in agriculture generally. One is that we are moving fairly dramatically to a larger proportion of the total R&D in agriculture being done by private companies compared to the public sector. Private firms have expanded their expenditures in this area very dramatically, and the public sector has been challenged to be able to grow its activity as rapidly as the private sector has. And so there are people who are concerned that now the private sector is more important and is capturing more of the benefits associated with this R&D activity, and are targeting those who they provide those benefits to. I mean, the argument of some is that larger scale agribusiness companies doing R&D are going to do R&D that is going to be applicable to larger scale farmers, and smaller scale or unique farmers, people interested in specialty crops, in organics, et cetera, don't have private sector focus here, and the public sector has not had the funding base to expand in those areas as rapidly as they would like. And so there has been a discussion of, quote, the people left behind because of this change in the R&D activity broadly in the agricultural industry. There also have been some changes, as was indicated, in terms of intellectual property rights, which now in biological property, which now allow private sector companies to protect their R&D activities more than they were able to historically in the past, and that then has given them more incentives to do this in the private sector compared to what it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago when those new innovations could not be protected under R&D, and so the public was more inclined to do them than private sector firms.
We have another caller on line two from Monticello. You have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I was just sort of wondering, you know, the the whole purpose of the farm bills back in the 30s was to generate, you know, or improve income for farmers, and we've taken that concept clear up here into the next century. And I just sort of wonder, you know, with new business practices where we're actually being a business as farming and have crop insurance and computers and internet and all the new technical tools and everything as business people, don't you think we've really sort of, taken a concept and totally illegitimize that somehow to where, you know, it's easier to have the farm bill than not to have a farm bill, or have the subsidies than not have the subsidies? I mean, everybody, there's no debate anymore of, you know, do we really need subsidies in agriculture? We have to have them. You know, always the concept is we have to have them, and there's never a debate on why we have to have them. I just wonder if you could talk about that.
That's an interesting topic. I appreciate, John, you calling in with that question. Bob, why don't you take that up for just a bit?
Well, it certainly raises interesting questions. I would just add that the caller has explained a lot of his concern and raised the question very well. There is debate. It's vigorous debate on this very issue. And it is going to get more heated for the simple reason that with the increasing budget difficulties that our country is facing, budget deficits rising rapidly, every sector is going to be interested in protecting whatever they have, whether it's R&D or subsidies or otherwise. And the debate that is going to certainly be very hot this time. And as Mike indicated, with the president's proposal, if indeed he's going to push that, it's going to raise the level of dialogue about the limitation of payments to a new level than it's been for some time. But this has been on the agenda right along. It will be there this coming year. And because of the budget difficulties brought on partly because of the defense spending, which is rapidly growing, it's going to make it much more difficult to sustain, certainly much less raise any of the transfer payments into the agricultural sector. I would just add both this caller and the previous one that the R&D kind of investments in agriculture, and certainly some of the price and income policies we have can be considered that way, even though most of them are more transfer payments. Most analysts have found that the R&D investments in the agricultural sector through the public institutions is really a subsidy, you might say, or an assist to the consumer. Indeed, they pass through the farmer, but because of the competition, because of the rapid use of technology, we might say they don't rest with the farmer very long. Rather quickly, they are transferred into the welfare of the consumer with lower food prices, more readily available food. And I think it's important to keep in mind that some of the USDA budget is a very strong subsidy to the consumer and to the health and welfare of the consuming public, as well as to the farmers.
Do you have a follow-up caller? Guess not. I want to stay with this R&D issue just a little bit, I want to talk about how the transfer of technology from research done on university campuses happens today, and whether that transfers directly into the public sector most of the time, or whether it's transferred into the hands of corporate America, and what kind of impact that has had on policy out of Washington. And I don't know whether either of you can or are willing to take that issue up. Mike?
Well, just a couple of comments. Certainly the R&D that we do in the university today shows up in terms of improved that shows up in terms of improved yields and reduced costs. Does get into the farmers' hands. In many cases, it gets into their hands directly through our outreach and extension services. And in some cases, it gets in their hands via the private sector, because what happens increasingly is some of this R&D results are licensed to private sector firms, who then are, if you will, the retailers of those ideas to the to producers and to those that use it. There has been a debate of this very issue of, again, when we changed intellectual property and allowed protection of these kinds of R&D activities, and when university funding pressures occurred, the public wasn't supporting the university at the same levels, there was kind of a confluence of two forces where the public sector said, well, if we can't get funding from our normal sources of federal and state spending, and we can get money through licensing intellectual property and providing that kind of intellectual property to a particular company, and now it's available and we couldn't do it before, budgets are tight, and so we need to think about alternative ways of sourcing the funding. So those two forces coming together did have some impact on whether universities and the land-grant system did exclusively their own retailing of information, or whether they started using private sector firms to do that dissemination of their R&D results. There has been a change in the last 20 years in terms of that process. So what happens now is some of that R&D results do get retailed through private sector companies, and certainly in that process, a private sector company may be inclined to get a margin on that R&D activity, but part of that is license payments back to the university for doing the original work.
Time goes by very quickly. We've got about 4.5 minutes left before we have to end our discussion. Bob Spitzi, I do want you to take up the 1938 Act, which is the act upon which most of the Farm Bill would revert if one weren't put into place when those sunset. So if the 2002 Farm Bill were to sunset, this act would take its place. What's there that most of the farm policy that we use today is based upon and would not change very much?
Well, it's pretty much a fantasy to even think in those terms, Todd, even though that's a bit of a scare tactic. It's often used when we get into a conflict in the congressional caucuses as to if we don't do something, well, you're going to have to face it. We'll go back to very high price supports and production controls, and we'll be out of the world market. But it's there. And perhaps it serves that purpose, but in real terms, there is no real likelihood that we would ever relent to that. We will continue to do piecemeal changing and evolving to solve the current problems as best we can and come out with the compromises from these conflicting positions. But I don't think we want to be terribly concerned that suddenly we're going to have that. But it does mean that we have to keep our eye on the ball. What are the issues today? What are our priorities? Who are we trying to help? How? And how in the world are we going to manage the budget crises that are befalling all governments, not just the federal government, but obviously the state and the local governments also.
Any closing comments from you, Bob, on the history of farm policy and agricultural policy in this nation?
With this, agriculture and food policy is important to everyone, not only as a consumer, but as a member of a community, a member of a civilized society. And I think it is important for everyone to try to get informed. What are the issues that are going to be debated? And look to your organization, be it a urban organization like League of Women Voters or Sierra Club or the Farm Bureau. Get with your people that you know, with the organization you're associated with, find out what the issues are, try to get informed, and make your voices known, because this is what happens in democratic society. The kind of policy we have, like it or not, is the kind we put forward with our influence and with the kind of legislators that we elect.
Bob, we appreciate you being with us. Bob Spitzi, of course, a professor emeritus from the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics, retired here at the Agricultural College on the campus of the University of Illinois. On the other line with us is Mike Bolgi, who is in the Ag Econ Department at West Lafayette in Indiana at Purdue University. Closing comments from you, Mike, for the day?
Well, let me just extend Bob's comments one bit further, and that is that increasingly we see other groups who ought to be and are expressing interest and concerns about farm policy, whether it be environmental groups, conservation groups, people interested in trade issues, people interested in new forms of production, including organic, et cetera. And so Bob's point is appropriate. It's not only all of us as consumers that ought to have an interest. Is farm policy is not just for farmers. It's for farmers, agribusiness, consumers, bankers, and increasingly a broader set of even people that have a broader set of issues in agriculture and in rural communities to be engaged in.
We appreciate you both being with us, and thank you very much for this discussion. Thanks, gentlemen, for being online with us today.
Enjoyed it.
Mike Bolgi and Bob Spitzi joined us this afternoon. Both are ag economists, one from the University of Illinois, retired. That would be Bob Spitzi. And Mike Bolgi from Lafayette and Purdue University. We appreciate having them here on our first in the series of six farm policy discussions that Dave Dickey and I will lead over the next, five Thursdays now. Again, we'll be back next week with another one of these, and we hope that you enjoyed it and that you will join us again next week. You're listening to The Information Advantage. This is WILL Urbana.